This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This is a day to look under the hood of this economy, supply chains and food banks and big pharma and the cities in which we live. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday today, April the 13th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. When and how this economy starts working again is pretty much the question of the day. And to that point, there is something of a political, well, let's call it spitting contest, shall we? Becoming clear in a nutshell, who is going to decide? The president or the governors of the states? Setting aside for the moment the fact that the president can't reopen what he didn't close, governors on both coasts, where the outbreaks have been the worst, have decided today they are done talking about it. The governors of Washington, Oregon, and California, and in a separate announcement, the governors of six states in the Northeast say they've got plans to reopen. They're going to roll them out this week, and that they will be guided, those plans will, by science and health policy experts. Slow, I think, is the buzzword on this. Shut down, though large parts of this economy might be, there are essential industries, as we all know, among them grocery stores, for which we are all grateful. And if you've been to the grocery store lately, and we remind you here that you should only go if you have to, you've seen some empty shelves. Still, rice and pasta, yes, also toilet paper. People have been stocking up. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, these shortages aren't just about people panic buying. Think supply chain, gang.
Before COVID-19, when we went to the supermarket, we were used to seeing shelves jam-packed. Jim Luke at Lansing Community College calls that an inventory illusion.
The reality is that stuff is flying off the shelf. It's an extremely efficient, tightly controlled or run supply chain.
He says when we're talking about toilet paper, the problem is that so many of us have been told to stay home.
What's called the retail product, which is what we use in our home, is a very different product than what is typically used in what's called the away-from-home market. Businesses, corporations, factories, hospitals.
Commercial TP often comes in bigger rolls that wouldn't easily fit in a home bathroom. It starts with a different kind of wood pulp, it's packaged differently, and it's delivered through a separate transportation network. Which means companies can't just turn on a dime and start producing more retail product. Sunil Chopra teaches management at Northwestern University.
All you need is, in a supply chain like this, one short-term shock that happens for 2 or 3 days, and it takes a long time for the supply chain to work its way back to a stage where everything is back to normal.
These supply chain complications aren't just affecting the toilet paper aisle in your grocery store, though. Shelley Miller teaches sustainability at the University of Michigan. She says food companies have to adjust to the new reality, too. They're selling a whole lot less product to restaurants these days.
Under normal circumstances, we spend about half of our food dollars eating outside of the home. Over the past few weeks, we've transitioned drastically to consuming most of our food inside the house, and that's actually put a lot of strain on supply chain.
Meat suppliers, for instance, sell in bulk to restaurants, but to single families in grocery stores.
So unless there's a way to change the wholesale supply chain, there's just going to be a mismatch there until the supply chain is able to keep up and catch up with the change in demand.
She says it is getting a little bit easier to get your hands on foods that were in short supply just a few weeks ago because manufacturers have shifted things around. As for toilet paper, it's hard to know when supplies will normalize, but consulting firm NC Solutions says demand has softened since the middle of last month, which could make it a little bit easier to pick up a couple of rolls next time you're at the store. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The United States Postal Service doesn't get a whole lot of respect from a whole lot of people. The mail comes 6 days a week. A first-class stamp costs 55 cents. You go down to the local post office branch to mail a package every now and then. What more is there, right? Well, there's a lot more, actually. And reports over the weekend that the USPS might not get what it needs from the coronavirus relief package brought about predictions of its imminent doom. That is not likely now. But as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, it would be a problem for a whole lot of Americans were it to come to pass.
The little town of Wall, South Dakota, is known by locals as the geographic center of nowhere. Still, the U.S. Postal Service makes it there. To people like John Citrian, he gets his medication from the VA hospital through USPS. These days, he's worried that if services come to a halt,
it would require a 100-mile round trip. It would be quite expensive and time-consuming.
Companies like Amazon depend heavily on USPS. In rural areas, they take care of the so-called last mile of the delivery. Citrian says for a lot of Wall's residents, courier services like FedEx and UPS would be expensive. USPS has been in financial trouble for decades thanks to email, e-bills, and e-vites. Now USPS says the pandemic has caused another sharp decline in business. And Romina Baccia, an economist with the Heritage Foundation, says there's also the cost of keeping about 600,000 postal workers safe right now.
It comes down to actually providing them with masks and also gloves, cleaning their vehicles more extensively, all of the things to try and reduce the likelihood of the spread.
Legislators have raised concern about USPS having to shut down as it bleeds money. Richard Geddes is a professor of public affairs at Cornell University. He doubts it'll come to that, but he thinks the Postal Service needs to take this moment to make major changes.
Look, the Postal Service's fiscal model was not sustainable before the virus. Now it's collapsed, you know, so let's just bring it into the 21st century. Make it more commercial.
Back in South Dakota, John Citrian says he's been thinking about these family memorabilia he has, letters sent to the town of Wall over a century ago when the city was born.
During the war, of course, the ones that were serving overseas sent back letters.
And he's worried that, like those letters, the post office could become a relic of a bygone era. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
A sidelong glance at the calendar shows we start a flood of corporate earnings reports tomorrow. The big banks are up Tuesday, and you can't see me right now, but I'm doing that shruggy emoji thing because that's what those reports are going to be like, I'm telling you. On Wall Street today, down, but not a lot, relatively speaking. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For millions of Americans, specifically the nearly 17 million Americans who've lost their jobs in the last 3 weeks, this crisis means just one thing: uncertainty. How are they going to pay their rent? How are they going to make it through? Also, how are they going to get their next meal? Back in December, in other words, forever ago, we had Claire Babineau-Fontenot on the program. She is the CEO of Feeding America. That's a network of about 200 food banks across the country. And we've gotten her back on the phone today to talk about how things have changed in the last, like, month, 6 weeks. Claire, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
Things have changed since last you and I spoke 5-6 months ago. How much of an increase in demand are you seeing for your services?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. When we last spoke, we were serving about 40 million people. Since then, we're expecting an increase because of COVID-19 of 17 million people over the course of the next 6 months that we'll have to serve. I mean, it's really unprecedented.
Yeah. How are you, to use the business phrase here, how are you resourcing that, right? Because you need donations both of food, you need to get source your food, and you need to source money, too.
That's absolutely right. So the good news is we've had a remarkable outpouring of support across the spectrum. The challenge is that the gap is so big that we haven't filled it yet. So how are we doing that? What do we need? So we certainly need funds, we need food, and we need volunteers across our organization. And I have a lot of confidence in the infrastructure that we have in our network. We're really built to serve in moments of crisis like this, but we absolutely do need help.
It's tricky, though, getting volunteers now, right? When we're all supposed to be at home.
It is. And the vast majority of our 2 million volunteers in normal times are over 70 years old. So we would not want them to sacrifice their health and safety in order to do this work right now. And as a consequence, you know, that's had an additional headwind for us. But we've had the National Guard come in and help. And again, the gap is so big, we haven't closed it completely, but we are making some progress.
Is this crisis changing how you do what you do, or are you just doing it more and faster and in larger quantities, if that makes any sense?
It's a mix of both. So we're leaning heavily on the things that we knew how to do so well. But we're absolutely having to change some things in terms of the model. Like, for instance, in order to be safe, we're having to change how we deliver food to people. When your audience sees on television or in person, witnesses some of these long, long lines of cars that are queued up, they generally are going to a mass distribution where members of our team are loading their cars with food in their trunks so that we can practice social separation. So there definitely have been some significant changes in the interest of the health and safety of the people who are in our organization, but also the public who's coming to us when they need us so much.
If this goes another, you know, like 2 months of the current state of quarantine and then, you know, rolling waves of it as we try to get back on our feet, you going to be able to hang in there?
We're going to do everything we can to hang in there. But I can tell you that if we don't get significant assistance, which includes federal assistance, which we're hoping is coming really soon and will kick in over the course of the next, let's say, 4 weeks or so, the situation could become truly critical. And even beyond this crisis, when the health pandemic is no longer top of mind. If the past recession is any indication, there are going to be people who are going to be turning up to us for help for years to come. With the last recession, we just got to pre-recession rates of food insecurity in 2019 for the 2009 recession. So I keep asking people to go to www.feedingamerica.org. In addition, they can find a local food bank that serves the communities that they care most about. So there are multiple ways that they can help at a time when I'm sure so many people are wanting to help and just don't know how.
Yeah. Claire Babineaux-Fontenot is the CEO of Feeding America. Claire, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time. I know you're busy.
Thanks. I hope the next time it will be for better news, Kai. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, ma'am. Me too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Coming up,
we trick ourselves into thinking that all time at the office is well spent, but it's not.
Guilty as charged, so lighten up, all you people working from home, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, on a Monday, the Dow Industrial's off 328, 1.3%, closed to 23,390. The NASDAQ gained 38 points, about 0.4%, finished at 8,192. The S&P 500 shed 28 points, 1% there, 27.61 on that index. JP Morgan Chase, which posts results, as I said, tomorrow, slowed 4.4%. Today, Wells Fargo gave back 5.3%. Cruise lines plunged as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention extended the no-sail order for cruise ships because, of course, Carnival steamed down 7.4%. Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings dropped 13.3% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Businesses are competitive. Yes, that's just the way it works in normal times. These, though, are not normal times. And so the pharmaceutical industry, where research and development costs can be enormous, as can the payoff if there's a breakthrough, that industry is being a good deal less cutthroat than it usually is in pursuit of treatments and vaccines for COVID-19. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on the pandemic economics of pharmaceuticals.
The first treatment for COVID-19 that anyone gets is their own immune system, the antibodies our bodies produce. Nigel Paneth is harvesting those antibodies from the blood of thousands of Americans who've already had COVID-19. He's an epidemiologist at Michigan State.
The use of convalescent antibody from people who've recovered from a disease has been used in medical practice for over 100 years.
Take the antibodies out of recovered people, put them in very sick people.
It was, in fact, the mainstay of treatment of infectious diseases before antibiotics came in.
Paneth says it's not yet proven to work for COVID, but he's pretty sure it will. He's running an investigation. It is a laborious process.
You have to identify the donor. You have to confirm the donor really does have antibodies. You have to take their plasma. It's felt that each donor has enough volume to perhaps treat two people.
So private sector companies, at least 20 of them, and many more research labs around the world, are racing to grow antibodies in the lab. Lance Baldo is chief medical officer at Adaptive Biotechnology.
We're moving with handshakes. We're foregoing a lot of the normal kind of agreements that we'd make between companies. And most importantly, there's very little, if any, frank talk about, you know, any economic benefits from this.
Adaptive is using algorithms and lab tests to scan tens of thousands of antibodies from volunteers to identify the strongest ones and working with biotech company Amgen to produce them at scale. Super potent antibodies could be used as treatment. They could also be used as prevention for healthcare workers.
And so we could give them something that's often called passive immunity. So by giving them these antibodies, the thought is that they can actually neutralize the virus.
The level of cooperation generally around coronavirus is unusual, according to Esther Crofa, executive director of Faster Cures, a think tank.
It's actually quite historic, the level of collaboration that we're seeing to try to speed up the process as much as possible.
Industrially produced antibodies could start clinical trials as early as June. Crofa estimates they could become more widely available in 4 to 6 months. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
6 feet sounds like a lot of space, but on a narrow sidewalk in a crowded city, it just ain't, which makes social distancing sometimes more of a goal than an attainable reality. There are some places, though, that are experimenting with closing streets to cars to leave more room for pedestrians and bicycles. Marketplace's Jack Stewart looks at how this pandemic could be changing how we use our built environment.
We know the car is king here in Los Angeles, but over the last few weeks, while we've all been staying at home, so has the king in our garages and driveways. I'm on Hollywood Boulevard, and there are up to 6 lanes for cars here. And on a Monday, this would normally be packed. Today, there's some traffic, but it's really pretty light. The pedestrians, though, are still squeezing past each other on a sidewalk that's maybe 8 feet wide. And that's if you don't duck around the trees and the benches and the bus stops. This past weekend, up in Oakland, the mayor, Libby Schaff, closed 74 miles of streets to through traffic.
This is an effort to give Oaklanders space to spread out.
Philadelphia, Minneapolis, and Denver are amongst the other places trying something similar. So is Boston, where Jonathan Burke, an advocate for walkable urban communities at Patronicity, took advantage of a closed street on Saturday.
It was not packed, but I think well spaced out with rollerbladers, bikers, walkers, pedestrians.
Burke says New Zealand is out ahead of other countries. The government is funding every city there to make changes.
They're viewing this, rightfully so, as an opportunity to kind of say, okay, we can rearrange our land use patterns in downtown to allow for more space for people to move safely, go back into restaurants, go back into bars, stores, and start moving the economy again.
Closing streets doesn't have to cost a lot, says Brent Todderan, a city planner and urbanist and former chief planner for Vancouver, Canada.
This pandemic has really revealed how little space we actually have in many cities for people because of all the space we've given to cars.
And with urban dwellers stuck in small apartments, it's highlighting how important public space is. In Los Angeles, I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Every now and then we see a thread on Twitter that just kind of resonates, whether it's navigating the healthcare system or working parents dealing with their kindergartner's Valentine's party, or as today, working from home in the middle of a pandemic. Peter Martin's a reporter for Bloomberg News based in Beijing, so he's got some expertise on the aforementioned topic, also some advice on how to make it just a little less painful.
Tweet one. So you're going crazy under lockdown. I know the feeling. I've been in Beijing for the last 2 months. My housemate is away, and I'm thousands of miles away from my family. I have some thoughts on how to make lockdown better. They won't apply to everyone, but they ring true for me. Tweet 2. No, things will get better. The first few weeks of lockdown felt pretty oppressive, but now I'm kind of used to it. Even if the lockdown goes on longer than expected, you'll get used to your new environment and likely grow more comfortable with your own company. Tweet 3. Have a routine. Fill it with stuff that makes you feel good. It might be home workouts, cooking, or learning something new. It might be a TV show that calms you. I've rewatched The Office and Parks and Rec. You'll get your work done, but don't let that become your only focus. Tweet 4. Be careful with technology. Seeing pictures and doing video calls with loved ones has made this whole experience much easier to deal with. Don't underestimate the difference between hearing someone say they're doing okay and seeing it with your own eyes. On the other hand, my social media feeds are full of anxiety-inducing outrage and doom-mongering. I need social media for work, but I've started logging out of Twitter when I'm done with my workday, and I'm limiting my time on Facebook. It helps. Tweet 5. Appreciate little changes that improve your life. In my part of Beijing, so few people have been out on the streets that strangers now nod as they pass each other. It's a small thing, but it's kind of beautiful, and it reminds me of the small town in England where I grew up. Tweet 6. Don't hate yourself for not being constantly productive. We trick ourselves into thinking that all time at the office is well spent, but it's not. Your day at home will include idle moments, and that's okay, even if it takes you to parts of YouTube that make you question your self-respect. Tweet 7. Accept that you're stressed. You're worried about yourself, your family, your friends, the world. And there's a sense of fear lingering in the air. Don't try to talk yourself out of it. Tell your friends, write it down, meditate, exercise. Do whatever you need to do to deal with it. Tweet 8. Talking of stress. Don't feel guilty that you're consumed with your own feelings when others like doctors, the elderly, or the socially isolated have it harder. Your stress is real too, and unless you deal with it properly, you won't be able to support others. Tweet 9. You're going to have off days when you just feel really crappy and sorry for yourself. That's okay. It would be kind of strange if you didn't. Take some time off, do nothing, relax. Write a line under the bad day when you're done and start a new one tomorrow. Tweet 10. Write to people you don't contact often enough and ask how they're doing. I was really touched when people did this for me. Others will appreciate it when you reach out. The social contact and sense of solidarity will probably make you feel good too. Tweet 11. Above all, be forgiving. We're all stressed. We all have different ways of coping. And we all experience moments when it's too much. If you or others don't live up to your usual standards, try to move on and get back to binge-watching your favorite crappy show.
That was Peter Martin. He's at Bloomberg News in Beijing. You can find him on Twitter at PeterMartin_PCM. And if you come across a thread you think might interest us, shoot it our way. You can get us at Marketplace on that website. You can get me at Kai Rizdal. I'll spell it here because they make me. KAIRYSSDAL. Maybe the last time I'll trot this one out until it gets under, I don't know, 50,000 or so. But I do like it a lot. It touches on a lot of things. The number of airline passengers that TSA screened yesterday as compared to a year ago. So yesterday, 90,510 people. A year ago yesterday, 2,446,000 people. I just think this is an amazing statistic. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 328 today, about 1.3%. The NASDAQ gained 38 points, about 0.4%. The S&P 500 down 28, 1% there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.